against India. Didn't carry it with me, but the city press carried an article on that, which I thought was very good. Or did carry it. So those of you who wish to have a look at it, you may do so. Child of the Sea. City Press. I'll have it distributed to my colleague's assistance here. All right. Where were we when we left last week, Mr. Bassett?
Thank you, Chair. We finished Chapter 3. The last thing that we did deal with was, of course, fees. So we start with Chapter 4 now, that's professional conduct and establishment of disciplinary bodies. So, Chair, the Chapter 4 and Chapter 5 are very much linked to each other. Chapter 5 deals with the ombud. Maybe I can just take the members back and get your assistance on how to proceed. As I say, Chapter 5 deals with the ombud, and the way the bill reads as introduced, it gives the ombud powers of review on disciplinary matters. And we were asked to prepare an option taking away that review power of the ombud. There was a view expressed quite strongly, but the question still remained when we left, was what should the powers of the ombud be? Should the ombud have decision-making powers to review disciplinary matters, or should the ombud be more of a watchdog in the form of, for instance, the example was mentioned, the public protector, where the ombud really has recommendatory powers rather than decision-making powers? And the committee asked research for research to be done on the powers of ombuds, legal ombuds in other jurisdictions, as well as to have a look at national laws where other ombuds provision is made for other ombuds, and to have a look at their powers, whether they're recommendatory or decision-making. Although ombuds in other areas, not the legal sector, I don't know to what extent can we use those examples, but it might be good to have a look at what the research has revealed in respect of ombuds in other countries. As I said, we were asked in this Chapter 4, there's a provision, I think it's Section 42, which gives the ombud the power to review decisions of the disciplinary committees. The bill is introduced, if I can just refresh your memories. as far as discipline is concerned, makes provision for an investigating committee to investigate any allegations of misconduct, for a disciplinary committee to adjudicate on the charges that are laid, and then for an appeal tribunal to hear appeals by legal practitioners if legal practitioners are unhappy with the outcome of the disciplinary committee. The ombuds' review powers were only in respect of the complainant, the client or the attorney or advocate. Only the complainant could go to the ombud to have the matter reviewed. So there were two separate mechanisms, one for the legal practitioners and one for the complainant. We were requested to do an option in terms of which the appeal tribunal deals with appeals not only for legal practitioners, but that the clients can also take their appeals to that appeal tribunal if the ombuds review powers are taken away. So what we've done, Chair, is we've given effect to that general instruction, and when we go through the provisions, that is what I'll be doing in greater detail as we go through each of the individual provisions. But that is the arrangement or the structure that we were asked to have a look at. Maybe that by way of introduction. as I say, there has been some research done on the powers of the Umbra, but that's in chapter 5. I've got a loose document here, because it wasn't in the document that I gave to you last week, setting out an alternative powers and functions for the Umbra, more in line with the watchdog type of Umbra.
Well, I was just to say that I, for one, would be grateful if Advocate Bassett took us through all of this, because I'm nowhere near making my mind up. I looked very briefly at the comparative analysis of other statutory provisions from South Africa, but they're financial, and they were, this is different. It's a different discipline, and everything about them is, I didn't find them particularly useful. But what would be more useful is to read it, that all the comparative foreign ombuds, but that I haven't done.
I think the parliamentary advisors did some research there, and I know we did a little bit as well, so when we get there, you tell us when you want to hear us on that, either now or perhaps when we get to the relevant provisions.
I'm not sure where we are. We're going to start on chapter 4 now,
yes,
and start the whole disciplinary process, but you've gone to ombud, because that's the appeal side, and that's the open. So we're going to start going through the whole disciplinary process, and then we'll deal with the ombud and the issues around that. Yeah,
yeah.
No, that's fine.
4 and 5.
Okay.
So then we start on clause 36, that's code of conduct, that's the first provision in chapter 4. The first amendment, let me read it, the council must develop a code of conduct that applies to all legal practitioners, and we added that's in line with the principle that the committee seemed to adopt last time we met. The code must also apply to all candidate legal practitioners, so those are the only amendments in clause 36. May I continue, Chair?
Yes.
Clause 37 deals with the establishment of disciplinary bodies. Now, disciplinary bodies in the definition means investigating bodies and investigating committees and disciplinary committees. And 37.1 says that the council must, when necessary, establish investigating committees, and there was a suggestion, I can't remember from who, to say consisting of at least three persons to conduct investigations of all complaints against legal practitioners, candidate legal practitioners, or juristic entities. Subclause 2 says an investigating committee must, after investigating a complaint, if it is satisfied the practitioner may be guilty of misconduct, refer the matter to counsel for adjudication. The counsel will then establish a disciplinary committee to adjudicate the matter. If investigating committee is of the view that the legal practitioner is not guilty of misconduct, must inform the counsel as well as the complainant and the legal practitioner of its finding and the reasons for it. Chenna, what we've got in the rest of this are options, and maybe I shouldn't have put this in. I think we mustn't lose sight of the fact that anybody can take this on review in terms of PUDGA, so this is one of the options. If the legal practitioner or if the complainant is unhappy about the outcome of the investigating committee, it could take the matter on review in terms of PUDGA. I leave that. That is not in line, or that is not what the committee requested us to do. The committee requested us to ensure that if the attorney or advocate or complainant is unhappy, then it goes to it can go to an appeal tribunal. So the alternative to paragraph B is in line with the committee's instruction. If the investigating committee is of the view that the practitioner is guilty of misconduct, must go to the council, must establish an investigating committee, and the matter can then be can be appealed to the appeal tribunal established in terms of section 42. If the complainant is aggrieved by the manner in which the investigating committee conducted its investigation, or if the complainant is unhappy about the outcome of the investigating committee. This is limited to the complainant because obviously if the investigating committee decides not to take the matter further, I'm sure the practitioner is not going to take the matter any further. Subclause 4.
There are a whole lot of issues here. The first is which one needs to decide is, does all this go into the regulations or not? Remember, that was a submission from the Law Society, whether the detail should be in the regulations or that, and that's a separate issue we can deal with. Then, of course, your investigating committee should 37(1), the various options we've got there that we need to look at. The Law Society recommended that you should have a delegation, should be able to delegate to a low official for minor offences. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't want to have an investigating committee of three trying to deal with one minor offence. But the main issue that I want to address is 2B, the judicial review. Now we know judicial review is common law or in terms of PADGA. So why are we saying specifically that it must be under PADGA where the complainant can take it on review? Is there a specific reason why you're referring to that? Should you not just say review? Because it's common law which is wider than your section 6 of PADGA. So that's something we need to consider as well. And then of course your that's for the complainant, as you correctly say. Your accused person, he can go on appeal and review after labours, and that you don't even have to say that in legislation, surely.
Chair, to respond to the review question, yes, that's something that one can consider. But if the committee decides that there's going to be an appeal tribunal for both the complainant and the attorney or advocate, then the review, we don't need to surely say anything about the review. And I think that's the way the committee, if I understand the committee, that's what the committee was saying, that the appeal tribunal should be able to deal with the outcome of the investigating committee where the complainant is unhappy, and should also be able to deal with the outcome of the disciplinary committee if either the legal practitioner or the complainant is happy about the outcome. So my sense is that the committee wants the investigating committee, disciplinary committee, appeal tribunal, and not to really talk about review. That is, they automatically, one that doesn't need to really say anything about the review. So we can leave it there. But as I said, the way I read interpreted in the instructions, it's disciplinary committee and appeal for both the complainant and the legal practitioner.
Just remind me, was it our thinking, if that was our instruction, was it our thinking that the ombud now no longer does review? So this is alternative.
That was very much open-ended, and we were asked to prepare an option along those lines. And that's why this chapter is saying to link with the ombud and the powers of the ombud.
I think this may be what the Honourable Steve was alluding to. What about the point made by both the attorneys and the advocates that you sometimes want abbreviated processes for some things, especially where a person pleads guilty, and also that you want to say in so many words that it's only where there's prima facie evidence that you're going to proceed with all this investigation, etc. Because the figures we were given, possibly by Mr. Dyer, I don't recall, is that there are very many misconduct allegations. 8,000 in the case of the Oberengmeitrich, of which only 200 actually led to inquiries, right? And the DCB said there are lots and lots of complaints. Each chamber should deal separately with its own. So what was our conclusion in that regard? I do see that these clauses say the council must, when necessary, establish investigating committees, which perhaps implies that you must be quite sure that there's a prima facie. What was our thinking? Should we spell it out?
Jefferson, it is for that reason that I think the addition was that there will be delegated authority to officials, because at that level, a lot of the cases, prima facie, do not have to go beyond that initial stage. It's so obvious.
Mm.
And so the delegated official has, if you don't give that person the authority, like the CEO or whoever, or the head of professional affairs, you have an unnecessary volume of matters that must go on to a committee level. So for that reason, there was the suggestion to have the delegated authority to the official to deal exactly.
Where's the delegation authority? No specific provision.
I don't think there's a specific provision as far as that's concerned. Members are asking now, shouldn't we make provision for a truncated process in the event of minor disputes? That we haven't done, but I think maybe we need to do it if the committee wants us to do that.
That's not a final position as far as I'm concerned. We also need to think about this from the point of view of the public. And once again, over the weekend, had an unhappy person. I mean, it's already the situation that the members of the public land are. If we allow for this delegation where somebody sifts the stuff and says there's nothing about it, we must just be sure that the public, an aggrieved member of the public, doesn't feel fobbed off or denied the chance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so therefore, at minimum, the ombud must have the power to take a look, if not fully review, that decision to proceed.
I think there wasn't a big debate about that. When we dealt with these provisions in the first place, was that every person who has a complaint must be seen to have it addressed, even if it is trivial or not that serious. And so we can come up with a provision to try and build in that, specifically build in a type of sifting mechanism, if that's what the committee is looking for.
Yeah.
That would then have to come, that is, the possibility is then that must lie with the ombud,
mm-hmm.
or but we in the hands of the committee there. One of the concerns when we were dealing with this, maybe it would be good just to highlight it, the council, I think we must bear in mind, the council establishes the investigating committee,
mm-hmm.
the council establishes the disciplinary committee, the council establishes the appeal tribunal. So I think maybe one must just bear that in mind when we consider this model. I merely raise that.
What's your point? I mean, I think I know what that is.
Yes, well,
what's the point?
There can be allegations that, you know, the council is still covering up through the whole process. But the counter-argument there, and that's what Mr. Jeffrey said when he was still in this committee when we discussed this, he says this is where the transparency of these structures must feature very, very strongly. Who is appointed, what is the outcome, and what we've tried to capture that in the model that we've gotten, we'll explain. I think the transparency, if this is the route we're going to go, the transparency of what goes on, how the structures are appointed, how matters are dealt with, and what the outcome of the matters are, must be very, very open and for everybody to see.
And even the proceedings.
And we have, mm-hmm. the committee requested us to board in, and we'll get to that as well, that the complainants and the public can be at these proceedings as well.
All right, there's several hands. Mr. Smart is waiting patiently. Mrs. Schaefer, and then Mr. Dyer. Mr. Swart.
I'm just trying to think of your formulation here under 2A, where the investigating committee brings out a decision as to person may be guilty. Surely one should refer to prima facie evidence there or something, because I'm a bit uncomfortable. I know it's a may, but surely there should be a reference that there's sufficient prima facie evidence of misconduct. And then my concern is that surely are we saying that an investigating committee of three people must investigate every complaint, or is it a committee of three where one person investigates one person? Because I'd be concerned if three people have to investigate every complaint. It becomes too cumbersome. Your investigator should be one person that then might prosecute the case later. And the disciplinary hearing can be open and transparent. But I think we've got to be careful to create a cumbersome process.
Mm.
And then, Chair, we'll get to the process itself later, but this also lends itself to the possibility of the model that I suggested at a regional level of the two chambers, where you've got your counsel setting up the disciplinary investigation lab, but the actual hearing can take place at the regional level with the separate chambers. And that is something under the jurisdiction of the legal counsel at the top, where you've got ministerial representatives as oversight. Well, I just think that, Chair, again, the submissions are made in by the LAWSA and by the CAPE Bar about the extent and the number of investigations, but the panel itself is maybe frustrated by the number of cases it has to deal with, and that you have legal practitioners frustrate the process by just having it delayed and it becomes too cumbersome. So, Chair, I would just say that is something for us to bear in mind as well. That is what the submissions have said. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just think, I mean, on the issue of transparency, that is obviously important, but we hadn't decided at what point the transparency should start. Should it be the hearing? Should it be just when the complaint is lodged or whatever?
Yes.
Now, my concern is that some people are habitual complainers about everything. And if every single complaint that goes on to somebody's record about, you know, is going to be recorded in a public forum, that is going to tarnish the person's reputation, and it may be unnecessary. Now, is it not worth looking maybe at saying when a complaint comes in? I mean, I also agree that at that point is where complaints can be covered up. Then the person in terms to say, well, no, we don't think there's a case, and they just doesn't go any further. Would it not be worth looking at something like a kind of almost automatic review situation in the, like we have in court for junior judges, when they impose a certain penalty, it goes automatically on review to the High Court? Which we could do that perhaps with the ombud. I don't know if it's going to be too much work, but if the ombud can, if every decision that is made not to take the matter further automatically has to be referred to the ombud for, and they can then oversee whether that decision was reasonable.
So at which point, is the public made aware?
Well, I would say when it's referred for an investigation. When it's referred for an investigation. Once it's been investigated and it's recommended that it be referred for a hearing.
That's
when it should be made public. But to prevent it from being covered up before that point, if a decision is made not to carry on, not to refer it to the disciplinary,
then
it goes to the ombud, and the ombud can decide if it wasn't reasonable, then we must build in some way of making sure that it then is referred for.
Mr. Dyer, and then Ms. Smith.
Chair, I think the suggestion from Honourable Shepherd is a terribly good one, because it has a built-in mechanism and safety net to make the process legitimate. So I think that's something that we should factor in. And then perhaps just in terms of the delegated authority to an official, I might have been swayed by the power that can be delegated to the executive officer under 19(2), where the executive officer may be assigned certain duties and tasks. And the interpretation could be as wide as the one that I alluded to, but hopefully now that we're discussing it in more detail, that certainly should not be the intention. As I interpret it, as far as that. And I think in the discussion, it certainly was never the intention that it should be a delegated official that would be able to make a judgment call in that manner, and it stops there. It might be that there's a committee and persons employed by the Law Society, officials, that deal with matters and decide, because practically that is what happens. You have the head of disciplinary affairs, who is an attorney, minimum qualification, that understands the law, understands the process, and he or she has assistance. They go through all of the complaints, and at the level where they know it's simply frivolous, trivial, I would imagine that there's a level of confirmation or ratification by a disciplinary committee. I must imagine that that's the current process. But practically, if we implement what is being suggested by Honourable Shepherd, so how that would happen is because the intention, as Honourable Shepherd is saying, is not to have attorneys constituting these committees at that level, which is so many that they have to deal with. And if we are saying that delegated officials are going to be making that call on matters, and of course there's a guideline that, look, this is not going anywhere, then if what Honourable Shepherd says, if that kicks in, then there's a ratification process in terms of a decision made by officials.
On the same subject, let's just think about the numbers. I too think it's a good idea to have automatic review. The review in the same sense that the High Court does of magistrates' decisions. However, let's just think of the numbers. If the Law Society of the Northern Province had in 1 year 8,000 complaints, of which only 200 led to actual inquiries, then and that's just one of the four provincial attorneys' bodies. So let's just think whether how realistic it is to send very many thousands of these dismissed complaints to the Ombudsman, who in turn will simply delegate that to some official to read through them. One probably, it's in theory anyway good, simply because your disciplinary head in the Legal Practice Council, the simple fact that he knows all the stuff is going to the Ombud is therefore in theory will make him perform better. But as to how practical it is to expect the Ombud actually to wade through all this, and there that's where one must perhaps allow the member of the public who feels wronged to have some special access to allow them to inquire from the Ombud why it is that this thing was dismissed or was it justified in dismissed. Then also on a thinking from the point of view of the numbers of these things, since the advocates always also told us that there are very, very many complaints. We're talking about thousands of cases. And the question of devolution to the regions. In practice, if your Legal Practice Council is going to set up this disciplinary arm, which will be the first point of receipt for the complaints. Somebody there goes through them, decides which are the 200 that are actually going forward for full investigation and then hearing. It is, I think, anyway, de facto the case that they will have to refer to the regions, if you say so or not, but I think you might as well say so. And then what's worth thinking of is that precisely because the lawyers, just like the doctors, would tend to be predictive of their own, on the basis of their but for the grace of God, etc. If your case goes to the region precisely where you practice, that's where all these problems come in. But the safety measure in this case is probably the fact that the complaint in the first place goes to the National Council. So I'm thinking aloud now. So somebody at the national level, not from your own cozy and intimate region, is making the primary decision as to whether this must go forward. And once the national tells the regional, you now go forward to full investigation, etc. And so what we're doing is a kind of checks and balances system, which is, I think, healthy. But in the end, I think it's unavoidable that, because of their sheer numbers, unavoidable that the cases will in fact be referred to the regions. This is also why you actually have to have two chambers, or on as I argued the other day, or on the compromise, which I think Mr. Dyer very wisely suggested, you can call them committees, it's still the same thing, but you're going to have to split them up into attorneys and advocates. Same thing will happen with the disciplinaries. It's surely not the intention of the department that, or is it, that attorneys must as an advocate, vice versa, or a mixture of the two on each other, or what is the thinking? Surely, in practice, it's going to boil down to the attorneys in a region sitting on their own sinners, and the advocates in their own bar council sitting on their own alleged sinners. So we might as well say so.
Chairperson, the thinking of the department when it dealt with issues of discipline and not supporting the chairman was that the committees that are set up would be populated by legal petitions, irrespective of whether it's an advocate or an attorney. The issue from the advocates was that they didn't feel comfortable with not being in the majority when a particular matter affected an advocate, and they felt that the balance should be plus one for the advocate. That was their thinking. There was no objection to the mix, because the thinking was that legal ethics are legal ethics.
Okay.
It's legal ethics. So it's not so far apart. Of course, now that we've crossed the Rubicon, for want of a better word, in so far as advocates having the right to accept valid briefs subject to having a faculty fund certificate, it's even more closer in so far as any separation of ethics and rules. So it's getting more closer. And maybe that might be something that could be built into the committee structures, that when it comes to an advocate, you have plus one. But certainly there was no intention to have an exclusive separation at that level. Because when you violate a code of professional conduct, you do so as an officer of the court.
Mm-hmm.
And the codes are not different.
Another virtue that just strikes me as you speak, and that is that the impulse to protect one's own is diluted if you have attorneys and advocates, people from the other half of the discipline sitting. So that helps, in fact.
I'm not
sure about that. You're being so referred to.
Sorry.
Attorneys still refer to advocates, so advocates might have an interest in ensuring that the attorneys are kept happy.
Is that deeper or reefer?
Well, certainly not deeper.
You're talking about reefer.
Certainly not deeper, I guess.
Yeah, the business talk comes on that.
All right.
I think some of the questions that are being raised are going to come out as we go through the further provisions. I wonder if we I don't want to say let's just move on.
No.
I think some of these issues
will
come out as we
become clearer as we go along.
And then we can come back to this. Just on the point that Mr. Swart raised about the investigating committees. 37.1. The council must, whenever necessary, establish investigating committees or the consisting of at least three persons. I can't recall who suggested this, but Mr. Swart specifically raised this last time. Appoint, designate a person or persons, and the footnote refers to the question that he's raised here now. Why do we want an investigating committee of three persons? I don't think it's necessary. I think a person or one or two people can be designated, but the alternative, there's an option for that as well.
I think, Jay, if you have the situation like you had with the Pretoria advocates and the RAF matter, that was a massive matter, you might need a committee of three, you'd need the option to investigate that.
Mm.
But where it's your individual person, ideally that investigator would become the prosecutor or something like that, but it makes sense to have one investigator. And I think and remember, what we're building into the statute here is existing practice in disciplinary hearings already. So Mr. Dyer can maybe help him, but at the moment I'm sure there's only one investigating committee or member that investigates cases, brings it to the Law Society or the Provincial Council, Bar Council, and then the tribunal that hears it is the 3 or 5 members. Is that correct? I can't see why you'd have 2 people investigating one matter.
Chair, after the tea break, because there are different models that the provinces use, I undertake to make contact with colleagues at the law societies, and I'll give clarity to the committee. I undertake to do that today.
But my solution is the suggestion of the option.
The council's got the option, appoint one or more.
Investigating
one or more, you know. So you're not saying they must appoint 3 members to investigate a trivial complaint, you know.
Well, that is in clause 37 of the Constitution. So that's okay. So then we come to sub clause 3 of clause 37. Council must, whenever necessary, establish disciplinary committees. Here we're saying consisting of at least 3 persons, which we've just discussed, to adjudicate complaints against legal practitioners and candidate legal practitioners, and must also designate one of those persons as chairperson, presiding officer thereof. The committee, when we were last here, asked the department to insert a provision which regulates who is going to chair a committee of this nature.
So is it the council that designates the chair or the 3 persons?
The council,
Madam
Chair.
All right. But I just want to clarify that. Honourable members? Okay.
That was a request from the committee. Subclause 4, it is suggested, and this was in line with the committee's deliberations last. Subclause 4 deals with the constitution of these investigating and disciplinary committees, and it used to read, must have be established with due regard to ease of access by members of the public resident in various parts of the Republic, the need to promote efficient resolution of complaints, representativity in respect of race, gender, national and regional demographics, and the inclusion of members of the public. We were asked to come up with a different model that says more or less the same thing. We were also asked what does subclause 4A mean? Investigating committees must be established with due regard to the ease of access by members of the public resident in various parts of the Republic. We've tried to address that in the new 4. And new 4 reads the need for disciplinary. We've got there, and in brackets, the committee, if the committee could guide us there, you might not need to apply these criteria in the case of investigating committees, but they need to be applied in the case of disciplinary committees, and that's why investigating committees is in square brackets. The need for disciplinary committees to reflect broadly the racial and gender composition of South Africa must be considered when they're established. This is in line with the wording that we discussed last week. When establishing, question arises, investigating committees and disciplinary committees, the following factor must, as far as practicable, be taken into account: the ease of access by persons necessary for the finalisation of the matters in question. That tries to address the uncertainty the committee had with the previous wording. I hope it addresses it. The need to promote the efficient resolution of complaints made in terms of this Act, national and regional demographics, and then importantly, the inclusion of members of the public, as may, must be prescribed by the Minister in after consultation with the Council, the need to provide a cost-effective disciplinary system, and the requirements of administrative justice. So these criteria are mostly, they were in the original subclause 4, but have been subdivided and are intended to address some of the questions that are raised, that were raised by this committee when we last met. As I say, investigating committees, maybe it is advisable not to subject them to all these criteria. And I think the question was raised a few minutes ago, who's going to sit in on these, who are going to be on these disciplinary committees as advocates or attorneys looking after themselves, I think we've also got to bear in mind, and the important thing that the committee emphasised last was the inclusion of members of the public.
Does Mr. Smart again, sir?
Chair, I think at the previous hearings I indicated my discomfort with these provisions, but I understand the need for it, but it's just, if you remember what the Law Society indicated, they said it would be difficult to comply with this section. Disciplinary committees and investigative committees generally consist of two or three persons, and the desired representativity will be impossible to achieve. Now, I appreciate the need for setting these out, and that was under the previous C. That if you do not, and we need to phrase it in such a way as to whether if it's a compulsion, you immediately, and if you slip up on one aspect, you're opening yourself up to a review process. Doesn't matter if the attorney committed murder, the purely procedure of setting up the panel can be contested. And that has been my experience in disciplinary matters for many years. Doesn't matter what the merit is. So we've got to be careful that we don't set up an obstacle to the disciplinary process itself by requiring too much when it comes to representativity on the panel. So I just urge us to be cautious here when we're looking at this and to consider whether we are creating for ourselves a loophole for attorneys or advocates or legal practitioners that are seeking to find a way of reviewing the process at the end of the day. You go through this whole process, person's found guilty, he's committed a serious offence, then he contests the panel and the composition, and he says, this panel does not broadly represent the racial and gender composition of South Africa, and takes on that view. So all I'm saying is, whilst I appreciate the sentiment, are we not creating, in Afrikaans they say you click a lot, are we not creating an additional burden for ourselves, and maybe we need to find a way of looking at that. For example, you've got another debate in the Western Cape with the whole issue of coloured people in the correctional services, where there's a national demographic, and they're saying, but Western Cape is different. Now we're saying racial and gender composition of South Africa. You've got a Western Cape hearing with an advocate or something like that, and he's representative of the demographics of South Africa. You're opening up a whole debate, and what maybe the question is, is there any such requirement at present? Probably not. So this is now a statutory requirement that we are imposing, where previously it would be common law provisions relating to the procedural law setting up the panels in terms of your body's constitution, and I just urge caution. I can't really give a solution, because I understand why we're doing that.
Sure.
But you appreciate the obstacles we're setting up. It's like little obstacles, loops, hurdles you've got to get through to find a person guilty at the end of the day.
No, I think I said before that this whole representativity thing goes completely crazy. You're talking about committees of two or three people. Having said that, for the very same reason that we want black judges, women judges, white judges, Indian judges on the bench, for the broad legitimacy of adjudication, it's not a bad idea not to let the old boys club populate the committee. But your problem is just the numbers. You're talking about committees of two or three people. And so, for my part, I you could throw it out as far as I'm concerned, 4A. But the alternative, possibly, maybe we could add, because its phrasing is now the way it ought to be, but maybe we could there too add, as far as practicable. Is that a thought? Yeah, I think so. Let's put in as far as practicable.
As far as practicable.
Yeah, there as well. So that you don't have someone absolutely rebuff impossible requirements.
Mr. Swift?
Put exactly that, just before we mention.
Okay,
so
great minds.
Let's put that in there.
Great minds, okay. And then in B, I think it's fine. The one thing I think we must decide here is Roman 4, when establishing disciplinary committees, following factors must, as far as practicable, take into account. Roman 4, the inclusion of members of the public as must be prescribed by the minister in after consultation with the council. On the whole matter of what this is a regulator we're making, it should make the rules. On the question I raised last Thursday, regulators make rules, ministers make prescribed regulations. I had a look at ICASA, and in fact I see we use the word regulation there for ICASA's rules, which it gazettes, and that is the law, that is subordinate law. But just for interest's sake, we use the word regulation. Now here, why must the minister prescribe the inclusion of the members of the public in consultation with the council? Why can't the council prescribe it? It is the regulator. Are we afraid that they won't do it? But we're writing it into the law, then they must do it. The inclusion of members of the public as prescribed. Why does it need regulations at all?
Would you like him to respond?
Yes.
Or are you done with this?
Yeah.
Just from a technical point of view, that is a repetition of what is in the original, virtually a repetition of what's in the original subclause 4. The inclusion of members of the public as may be prescribed. So that really gives effect to what was originally in the bill. As I've said, I think, and the committee seemed to agree, this whole issue of regulations versus rules and who makes them and in consultation and after consultation is an exercise that I think, and I sense that that's what the committee suggested as well, is what we're going to have to talk about once the bill has, the committee has gone through the bill where that audit is done and we have a look at those issues.
Looking at that 4A and B thing, I mean, it is already in B where it says the following factors must, as far as practicable, be taken into account. Could we not just add in there the need to reflect broadly gender and racial composition and add that in as another factor? Or
I thought of that too.
One can do it. Why we did it this way is because A really gives effect to what's in the Constitution, but if we are going to go as far as practicable route, then we can collapse the two. Yes.
By the way, what does the inclusion of the members of the public mean? What does inclusion mean?
Yeah.
What we're saying really is transparency. And that's not up for consideration.
I read that and I said, well, it doesn't mean that people must be allowed to sit in on the disciplinary hearing, but rather that members of the public may be appointed onto the disciplinary hearing.
Yeah.
That's how I understand it, sir.
That's what I read.
If that's the way we intend, that's what the department intends. If it's not clear, then perhaps we should make it clear.
Okay, so layperson.
You're going to have to word it carefully because, as it's read there, the inclusion of members of the public.
So you have a panel of two, and it's both members of the public.
Yeah. You don't understand.
Member or members?
Yeah, to assist with our drafting alternatives, should we read the recommendation from the committee as being leave the minister out of this process? This entrench the rights of a member of the public to always be included onto a disciplinary committee. Because if we say the council may,
it may never.
So just for our drafting purposes, it could just be a system.
All right, let's bear that in mind. The point raised by Mr. Dyer is very important. We're giving the council the option of appointing a member of public or layperson. And as Mr. Smart said, they may never ever do so. Are we saying then that yes, at all times, at least one member of the public must serve as a disciplinary committee? Mr. Schaefer?
What if they don't want to, first of all? And I think
what
that
who doesn't want to?
Members of the public, what happens if you don't get enough members of the public who want to sit on it?
I don't know, 40 million.
We have the jury.
Well, maybe. Anyway, that's what I do think we should say as a minimum is that that the members of the public, sorry, I'm in this as well, in this.
We want the jury.
Is that we should the members of the public shouldn't be in the majority? I think we should at least maybe start with that.
All right. Okay. Jury system. Yeah, George Zimmerman.
Yeah,
all
the actors
are
being
saying.
Yes.
I think that the, of course, the board still have jury, you know, instance for jurors.
Yes. Okay. Have we covered all the questions you've put before us, Mr. Bassett and Mr. Dyer?
Yeah,
the thinking is that, yes, they must. All right. Spin up their name, and at least one.
And if we're going to require that, then we can't fit in this
sure.
As far as practical, then we have to
have
enough. Yeah. Where is that with these people?
I'm also interested to know how many cases actually end up at those disciplinary panel type units. I mean, we're talking about, was it 8,000? What was it?
200 out of 8,000.
200, so that's a lot, yeah, that's a lot less.
200 is a lot, or it's a lot less than 8,000?
No, the 200 is less than 8,000, so I was just thinking if there's 8,000 hearings and you've got to find 8,000 members of the public, that
200 is a lot.
But 200, but it's not the insurmountable amount. You have your criminal cases, you have your lay people, or your assessors you have to sit to. They paid a little honorarium or something, and that could be what we do. I'm not opposed to that, but it will be interesting if you've got one attorney, one advocate, and one member of the committee to deal with an advocate or an attorney.
One point to note is that the department can't even get you 200 disciplinary cases
a year. Yeah.
Okay, understand. And that's in one column, 200 out of one column.
And that's an entire department.
Yeah, it is by far the biggest.
How will the complainant, I'm going back to whether this will be heard at the council level or at the regional council level. Clearly provision must be made for the complainant if he or she comes from Kukuna. Be able to attend if the hearing is in at council level, Johannesburg.
Well, Mr. Dyer, I will tell you, everybody from Limpopo, Kunai, everywhere went to Victoria. I think it still does that. But whether they were encouraging attendance, I don't think it's a different story.
We're talking about the complainants.
Yeah.
We're talking about ordinary members. We're talking about the complainant,
yeah.
The person who made the complaint. Surely he or she must be allowed to attend.
Mm.
If he chooses not to, well, that's another matter.
He'd be required to give evidence, surely, at the hearing. If you're having a disciplinary hearing, depending on the nature of the charges, surely your complainant is the main person on which you base the prima facie evidence. But I would think that there might be, in terms of some rules, some fee for that, or covering or something like that, that you have. Criminal cases, but that's more your witnesses, it's not so much. Does it cover present criminal cases? You have a witness fee to attend criminal cases. And this is a statutory body now, it's not the, no longer a voluntary association.
Roman 1, the ease of access, our first meeting in 6 weeks is the finalization of the matter of
inquiry.
It's no longer a member of the public part, it's now an ease of access for persons.
Chair, we're also getting two who may attend these hearings, and we've tried to draft something on the line, along the lines that the committee asked us to, so we'll be getting to that shortly as well.
Okay.
So nothing more onerous than finding this as employers.
Can you imagine?
That's also recording.
Can you imagine?
Because your time is very difficult. Bad is time to discipline counselors.
Politicians.
Chair, the consideration for to participate at DC level, on what constitutes a serious matter? Would it come in at some stage for a subject to a mandatory cause on ethics and rules, or is that something that maybe I'm being presumptuous, that it's not a problem? Is the member of the lay public, he or she will participate fully in deliberations. The nature of the matter is a legal issue that deals with ethics, deals with rules. Would we have a written into the bill something that reflects, you know, it's like the vocational training, and we said for the advocates or the attorneys, you can't go to the court. Go and get your trial advocacy done, and then we'll reduce your period. Because the committee says, look, you know, this is a very specialist court, the High Court. So I'm thinking that if we're going to be allowing members of the public, as the committee is considering, would they also say, provided a cause approved by the council dealing with ethics and rules is undertaken?
No.
Or is that something that...
So
no.
What is your thinking? Can I ask Mr. Dyer, are you suggesting that, or are you...
Is there anything you see the fiddle with lay people allowed on to?
Mrs. Maxwell,
yeah,
please.
I know we're not having a jury system, but I mean there's jury training, because they realized that if you want to participate in a decision-making process, you need to have a basic knowledge of what's going on.
That wasn't just on that.
And if you want to participate for the first time in the country,
no, I understand what you're saying.
In a decision-making process of the livelihood and the possible annihilation of this person who is a legal practitioner, we'll have further rights.
Maybe an accountant, maybe an architect.
Well, how are they called? I mean, there's nothing written anywhere in the law about whatever they
ought
to be.
Yes.
How does that happen?
Oh, how does that happen?
As a lawyer, must the
yes, but it's,
yeah,
not,
but
it's not said that they must be lawyers.
As Chair, I'm just thinking aloud, maybe that's what the regulations or rules, whatever the case is going to be, should set out criteria. I think that is the situation with lay assessors in certain criminal matters, that there are committees that, I think it's in, and I speak under correction, I think there are committees that sit where the Chief Magistrate possibly presides over these matters to draw assessors in from the community. But I really am speaking under correction
there. Or we could do what the Judicial Service Commission Amendment Act did when those tribunals were created. Am I not right in thinking that they list the hours? Because your tribunal consists of X, Y, Z, and then there's a list from, you know, which is pre-compiled. Yeah. But so now that's it. All of this depends how strongly we feel on having an individual in the commission. And then we can create a list. I think that someone who's a big fan is not. And then we can make decide who must make the list. So, I mean, that's one of the things.
Maybe that the provision should incorporate that idea so that it doesn't get lost. I think it's an important aspect. If the committee would agree with that.
Yeah. Okay.
that takes us to clause 37.5. You'll see 5, 6, and 7, and 8 have been square bracketed and bolded.
Mr. Bassett, can we dealt with 5, 6, and 7? I'm looking here. Oh, I see. So that's where we're dealing with this.
So that will ask.
Yeah, footnote 130. Okay.
That's. I don't know, I can go through it all. I think it was Mr. Jeffrey who said these were misplaced and they should be possibly 42.
Okay.
So they will all feature in one way or another later on in the they haven't been lost in terms of. Then that takes us to clause 38,
mm-hmm.
Procedure for dealing with complaints of misconduct and procedure to be followed in disciplinary hearing. The council must make rules to determine the procedure to be followed by disciplinary bodies established in terms of section 37. And there, that is, we're incorporating clause 37.7. I just want to point out to the committee that clause 37.7 is now incorporated in clause 38. For dealing with all complaints of misconduct, I can move on to clause 38.2. Before the council makes any rules contemplated in subsection 1 or amends any rule, if I recall correctly, there were comments to say that this should be broadened not only to making rules but also to amending rules. These must be published. So that's a technical amendment in line with comments that were received. And then subclause 3 is new, Chair, and this is the aspect that was raised very strongly last time when we dealt with these provisions about the transparency. We've tried to put something down, and there are some aspects that we would need guidance. Particulars of all disciplinary hearings, including the particulars of the allegations of misconduct being dealt with, and the members of the disciplinary committees in question, the parties involved in the dispute, and that's a question that we would raise, and the outcome thereof, and any sanction imposed in terms of section 43 if applicable, must be published on the website of the council, updated at least once every month by the council, and be available for inspection by members of the public during business hours of the council and regional councils. This is intended to give effect to transparency, the importance of transparency that was raised. Maybe I should continue because 4 and 5 are in similar vein. Proceedings of all disciplinary hearings are open to the public unless the chairperson of the disciplinary committee directs otherwise on good cause shown, on application by a person having interest in the matter, or the committee asked us to do an alternative. The chairperson may, on good cause shown, on application by a person having an interest in the matter, direct that the proceedings of a disciplinary hearing be open to the public. And then sub 5 is also a request of the committee last time. A decision of the majority of the members present at a disciplinary hearing constitutes the decision of the disciplinary committee, and in the event of a deadlock, the chairperson has a casting vote in addition to a deliberative vote. Those are the issues that the committee asked us to address.
Should I ask for the alternative sub 4?
I think I've got my notes somewhere here.
Aren't they open by default? Isn't open as the default position?
Yes, and then
on
good
cause shown.
I think we were asked to come up with two options, a default position, so that's up for consideration.
That's
four. That's four, the one.
That's
the
default.
What is the difference between a cost of vote and a deliberate in addition to the normal
deliberative vote, which is normal vote, as a member of the committee,
right.
And the additional one is
president.
There's a costing vote in addition to a deliberative.
The idea should be an uneven number, and it should one depend on that and avoid that situation.
Yeah.
But you might have members that are absent,
yeah.
Yes.
That sort of thing.
Yeah.
On a given day.
On a given day.
so it's good to have a bed.
It may occur that there are two people that
comments, questions, or other ones?
Just thought of another thing.
Ms. Schaefer and then Ms. Adams.
I just thought of another thing. I mean, then we should also maybe look at saying that the member of the public can't be the chairperson of the disciplinary panel.
Why not?
Because unless they are, you know, trained in legal procedures and stuff, then maybe, but not otherwise. Especially if they're going to have potentially a casting vote on matters they may not fully understand.
The council will choose the member of the public as the chairperson.
Well, I don't know.
They do.
The minister
might.
Well, but in this case, the minister doesn't choose the chair.
I'm not sure. Isn't it a good idea?
Yeah, the minister doesn't choose the chair. The council chooses the chair, yeah. Ms. Adams?
Chairperson, clause C of 3C. I see footnote 135, it says in any event that the PC's guidance is sought on this aspect. I would propose that, especially if there's members of the public involved, that some sort of, for example, if you don't necessarily want your name to be mentioned, that an abbreviation of some sorts be, maybe if there's children involved, or if just Mr. X or Y or whatever, instead of you wanting your details as one of the parties to the proceedings, if you don't want that person to, if you don't want your details to be made public, because this is ultimately going to be made public. If I'm an ordinary member of the public and I have laid a complaint against an attorney or an advocate, but I don't necessarily want my details to be out in the public, because I might be embarrassed by it, or for whatever reason, it might be a child that is involved in this. So I'm saying, like, normally when there's children involved, there's normally like X or Y, this, instead of saying the person's name. So I'm just proposing that something like that be added.
We did say in the footnote there we would seek the committee's guidance whether the parties must be published, names of the particulars of the parties must be published.
I don't see any need for that. Because if you know, is the practice not naming and shaming, for example, that's basically what you're trying to do. The complainant's name has got no relevance there. So it's the person that perpetrated the misconduct. His name.
Well, Ms. Adams is saying the complainant's name must be kept up.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. I'm agreeing with that. There's no need for the complainant's name to be published on a website or something like that. That's purely the name of the perpetrator.
Would be the legal practitioner then.
Yeah.
Why? That's the outcome of the hearing. So-and-so was charged of misconduct and so on.
And you said
that
under.
Yeah, obviously. But why would the complainant's name be published?
Yeah.
In criminal cases, there might be media attention in criminal cases to say this person made a charge or something like that.
Yes.
But for the purpose of highlighting the misconduct of a particular person, I would think the intention is so that you are aware as a member of the public not to go to that attorney or something. Or
yeah, but the point is, if it's going to be an open hearing, then the people are going to be known in any event. The complainant's going to be known in any event. You can't prevent it. I mean, you're going to put the attorney's name, you know, in public. Why shouldn't
the
complainant?
Yes, the media come in with their cameras and they want to know who's the complainant.
Yeah.
You know, and then how do you prevent?
No, I'm not. Maybe we're just getting confused. Are we saying, are we talking about published on the website?
Yes.
Are we talking
about
open?
So it's kept out of the website.
I'm not
the hearing begins, the media and the public come in and they see the complainant sitting there. So how do you do that?
But it's
in news media.
It says the parties involved in the dispute must be published on the website of the council as it's presently formulated. So I don't have a major problem with that, but it seems a lot of information you're going to have to publish on the website.
Yeah.
All right, we can keep it out of the website, but,
yeah.
But
yeah,
it's fine assuming that, you know, that doesn't mean that that person's name stays out of it.
Yeah.
Unless, of course, there's an application brought that it's in camera, if it's a child involved or something like
well,
that,
that's
then that's something
that's
different.
Something else.
But otherwise, there's no problem with that. It's, we want openness and transparency, and that will be the situation.
Mm.
Unless the person brings a specific... might be some
and
sexual impropriety or something that the complainant doesn't want that in, and then they would bring an application that it should be heard in camera.
Yeah.
Fair enough. And won't the legal practitioner also, in fairness, also say, well, if my name is not public,
yeah.
The complainant's name should also be known.
Why not?
I mean, you could say that you don't put the complainant's name on the website, but if the media later picks it up, then it's absolutely, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. And the person's going to have to be present at the hearing anyway. But I think, in fact, we should take the opposite position. I think, you know, the complainants are as mad as a snake by the time they want to file the complaint. Some of them really have suffered the most dreadful prejudice, and I'm sure the vast majority would be only too delighted to have their name put up on the website. And then, well, I mean, all one needs to worry about is the cases where there are special reasons why you don't want the complaint, and then that's when we don't see stuff all throughout the case.
Mr. Simonelli and then Mr. Swart.
I was thinking in matters of criminal matters, is it not a normal procedure that even the media knows that if the complainant is a minor, that name will not be published? We don't find a specific regulation which says when a case is decided involving a minor, it's going to be referred to in the state X, so everybody accepts that. We all know that the minor's name is not.
I think it's in the right somewhere, but never for the point. Also, certain divorce matters will be changed. It's all there.
The details are.
Yeah, but in the law. So we're focusing on that.
Can I just mention, and I understand and I'm in support of the publication, but just to give an example, I'm dealing with a complaint of sexual impropriety against the legal practitioner, and this complainant is under massive pressure not to continue and pressure, and she's really gunning, she's instituted civil action in the High Court, but the pressure she's under to withdraw everything is absolutely almost unbearable. But she would not be averse to having her details published, but there is that sensitivity in the matter of it's my word against another person's word, and I'm told that I'm a liar and everything like that. So we need to also bear that in mind. But in the case of a criminal case, it would be that person would continue with a criminal case, her details would be published. At the end of the day, there'd be a credibility finding, and that's I'm just giving an idea of a sensitivity, but that doesn't defray from the argument that those details should be published. In that case, you understand what happens in the long run. But I think Mr. Simonelli correctly said there are situations set out in law where you can apply for in-camera hearings situations, and the presiding officer will then decide if it should be in-camera, those details come in. But it could be interesting then, if there is an in-camera hearing, surely then that should be reflected on our initial statement, because if the presiding officer decides that it should be in camera and make the finding, then that will also influence what is on the website. So we need to also, you follow, Chair? Because if the presiding officer says this information may not be published and it's heard in camera and the legal practitioner is found guilty, then the details cannot be published on the website. There's a consequential flow to that as well, which we haven't covered yet.
But
But the reason for in-camera hearing is to protect the identity of the people, of the complainant, I would think. We need to just be aware of that. We need to find a solution to protect the reasoning behind the in-camera hearing when we publish the results at the end of the day. The parties involved, I would think then that the parties involved in the dispute, subject to an in-camera hearing or something, you're going to have to put a subject to. Otherwise it defeats the purpose of an in-camera hearing.
Why don't we do an option under 2C?
Mrs. Schaefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we should also just bear in mind that allegations of like sexual misconduct and so on can also be abused the other way around. And if somebody is guaranteed anonymity, they can go make allegations against practitioners at will, and they may not be true.
That's what worries me.
No, so I think if we leave it as an application for an in-camera hearing, that's fine, and we need to protect the person. Complainant's identity if that is found to be meritorious, but I really think we need to bear in mind that it can apply equally one way or the other. It's your word versus mine, and it's not always easy to tell who's telling the truth.
Why don't we do, as I've sort of a running option, a 3C, a second option saying the parties involved in the dispute and based on good cause and the complainant proposes.
Something like that will be subject to probably one of the alternatives in subsection 4, for the open or closed proceedings.
Okay.
Mm.
All right. But
on the 2-4s, Chair, certainly the first 4 is we must go with the first 4.
I would have thought so.
Yeah, open it. Open it.
Right. So the second report comes out?
Yeah.
Okay.
Should we say the complainant can always be, will always be present?
Why would the complainant
prevent.
I would say that the complainant is not seen as a member of the public.
No.
He's an integral
the
part of the process.
Is in the matter.
So you would.
It's being waived.
Part is involved in the dispute.
So you've got the member of the public that sits on the committee. That's a separate issue.
Mm-hmm.
But this, what you're saying is that they might direct that the hearing is not open to the public. Clearly, the complainant must be there. He's an integral part, and I think there's. I don't know if we need to say it specifically because the complainant. I suppose if he's not to be called as a witness, that could be the only situation where.
Yeah, that's different.
Where they are.
I'm
quite
about
Cornell Island. Yeah. We should maybe add, provided that the complainant shall at all times be permitted to be.
We need to say that.
We might, because you could have a situation where the laws, the council or whatever is kind of prosecuting, and they're wanting to call the person as a witness or not, as the case may be, and they say, well, you don't need to be here. We are acting on your behalf. I don't know. But it's not worth, it's no harm in putting it in. It's terrible.
So that's a proviso that we're looking at the chair.
Very briefly. I see the complainant has been in several parts of the complaint. When we talk about a person with interest, we are thinking of any other person, but not the complainant. The complainant is the key initiator of the complaint.
Thank you, Chair. 39, I think we've concluded.
Yes.
39, maybe it isn't surprising that there are no amendments. These are pretty, I think, standard about subpoenas and all that sort of thing. Then, with your permission, we go on to clause 40.
Mm-hmm.
Proceedings after disciplinary hearing and remedial action. The question was just raised whether we should not talk about sanctions rather than remedial action because the content of the clause in question talks about sanctions rather than remedial action.
Chairperson?
I don't want to speak about penalties. Sorry, Ms. Adams.
I just want to go back to clause 39.
Yes.
Two specifically. Well, a disciplinary committee may appoint. No, not that one. For the subpoena.
Yes.
What happens if a person simply doesn't want to come?
CRS.
I mean, what can the disciplinary committee do? Because it says here in where is it now? 7A, a witness who has been subpoenaed may not fail to attend the hearing, fail to refuse to be sworn in, and all that kind of stuff. But what if the person simply doesn't come? What then?
It's still an offence,
any person who fails to comply, blah, blah, blah,
you'll
still an
offence.
Okay,
you're right.
And then clause 40, a decision must still be made about the heading. We've also asked in subclause 2, I'm just going to footnote, subclause 2 provides that a legal practitioner who's found guilty may address the disciplinary committee on in mitigation of sentence. Question was raised whether there shouldn't also be provision for aggravation of sentence, and we've included in subclause 3, if found guilty, the disciplinary committee concerned may call witnesses to give evidence in aggravation of the sentence. So that's been added. One of the sanctions is, in the case of a legal practitioner who's been found guilty, that the committee may order him or her to pay compensation, and the question was raised rather strongly whether this is not including or interfering with the courts when compensation or damages are awarded. It should go through a court, and we were requested to bring the court in, so it may order him to pay a compensation, which order is subject to confirmation by an order of any court having jurisdiction in the circumstances in the prescribed manner. And the same is the same amendment is included in subclause 3b in the case where a juristic entity is found guilty. And the other amendment in clause 40 is clause 43b4, where there's a reference to the High Court. The committee may advise the counsel to apply to the High Court. High Court is now defined. We don't need to say having jurisdiction. We've discussed that on a previous occasion. Then the next amendment is to subclause 7. It is proposed, it provides as follows: at the conclusion of a disciplinary hearing, the disciplinary commission must notify the complainant, the council, and the regional council of the outcome. It is suggested that if we insert a provision, new sub B, if the disciplinary committee finds that the legal practitioner is not guilty, it must inform the complainant of the right of appeal as provided for in terms of section 42 for the consideration of the committee. And then subclause 8, if the legal practitioner is found guilty of misconduct, counsel must publish the finding and the sanction imposed in terms of section 3 in the Gazette or the council's website as provided for in section 38.3, which we have just discussed. The question arises whether this should be done in the Gazette if we are now suggesting that it be done on the website. So it's still open whether the Gazette should remain. The Gazette is the is quite an expensive option, as we discussed last time, although this will not be pages and pages of stuff that has to be published in the Gazette, like the role of legal practitioners. This will be a once-off. We have already suggested that it be done on the website, which is possibly looked at more than the government Gazette, but we would appreciate the committee's guidance.
One's going to have to limit the costs and so on. So I'm inclined not to suggest that I should put it in the Gazette on the 8th, but we can look at that again. My main query relates to the order for compensation under 3A1, which order is subject to confirmation by any court. The process of that as compared to the process under sub 6, where you set out any court of civil jurisdiction. Now, the difference between the two, as I see it, is the first. You've got an order for compensation and you need to apply for confirmation by court as to the validity of the damages award. And under 6 you've got a specific amount legal which they failed to pay in accordance with the sanction. So you've got a separate process there. Just under what do you envisage will be prescribed under A1, Roman 1? Because the disciplinary committee makes a compensation order. Now they're going to have to decide damages, in other words. You now, then the council or is going to then apply to a court to confirm whether the ascertainment of their damages is correct. Under 6, you have got an amount and it's also covered, A1. Because now, if they don't pay the damage, if they don't pay the compensation, then you go to court again because they failed to pay the amount. Just trying to understand the correlation between the two. Firstly, does Roman 1 cover the objection by, I think it's the Law Society or the Bar Council, that the disciplinary hearing does not have the capacity to determine damages because it's a whole separate, like a criminal court trying to decide damages. And what we suggested was that that order must be confirmed by a court of law. But now, the court of law then has to ascertain the damages. Do you follow what I'm trying to get to? How are we giving that court the jurisdiction? Is the disciplinary committee going to say an amount of damages and have a hearing around quantums?
Mm-hmm.
And then apply to court and say, court, are you happy with what we've done?
That was the intention.
But who's going to take it to court? Surely it should be the same as under 6 on the application of the disciplinary committee, because otherwise the poor complainant is going to have to go to court.
That's why the words in the prescribed manner were put in to set out who does it, and surely it would be the disciplinary committee or the council, but that's why we thought regulations would be necessary there to deal with the detail. If the committee feels that it should be more specific, we could.
But I'm just trying to think, why do we have such detail under 6? Should we not just have similar detail under Roman A1? Together with interest thereon, as the impact of a civil judgment of that court. So maybe just look at tying up those two provisions. Because the one, you're going to set it all out in regulations, and here under 6 you're setting it out in the Act on the chance that the legal practitioner who's told you must pay the money doesn't pay it, and you set it out specifically, but you're setting out in regulations the main order. I don't see any other situation where a legal practitioner will be ordered to pay an amount that must refer to Roman A1. He fails to pay an amount in accordance with the sanction. Or it could be, I suppose, it could be a fine as well. It could be a fine, not only damages. So the fine that you impose for damages, that it's fine. I'm just. I can
you
understand it better.
Yes. No. I'm with you.
The second provision under 6 is a standard provision for when you don't pay a criminal sanction, a fine. Then you can go back to court and say it has the impact of a civil judgment, where you don't pay a criminal fine, for example. But yeah, we're saying if we impose a 1,000 rand fine on you, you don't pay that. We can go back to court. If a civil judgment, we can attach your property. One presumes that would be the same under prescribed manner under A1 then. If you have a damages order against you and you don't pay the damages claim, it will also be an automatic civil judgment. But that's the confirmation by an order of court. You don't have to change the fine to a civil judgment. The order of court will be in effect a civil judgment. No one's looking at me with this thing, but I understand. It's just maybe the phrasing is it. The one is going to be in regulations and the one is in the civil.
Well, I think I get what you're saying. I'll have a look, and you want the language tied up in the press.
Well, no, if it's necessary.
If it's necessary.
I'm just trying to think, like Section 300, is it 300 of the Criminal Procedure Act that allows damages for malicious damage to property? It's a similar thing. It's a compensatory order. If you don't pay in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, you've got to convert that to a civil judgment for attachment purposes. So maybe you look at the guidance. We did it in...
I don't want to delay the committee. But 3A1, the disciplinary committee is going to say this is what I think the damages are, and that's got to be confirmed by the court, and it's got to get to the court. And it's got to be confirmed in 6. An order has been made, and it's been confirmed possibly. But it isn't paid. And then it has the effect of a civil judgment.
See, what we've now introduced with our clause under Roman 1 is the additional, it's a complication now, because normally you wouldn't have that. It would just flow.
Yeah.
And it covers the incidence of an imposition of a fine that is not collected as a sanction. And then the fine is converted into a civil judgment. Now we are saying.
So the words on the line, you say, this is what should actually come out of it.
If a court reads this, then they say, but under 6, but 6 will now apply to A1 as well. That's what I'm saying. Not only to a fine, but will apply indirectly to compensation. I say, well, if you read 6 applying to A1, then it's pathological. It's not necessary because it is already a court order.
Okay.
But it's not an insurmountable problem. I'm just under. You follow, Lawrence, what I'm saying, because you don't have to then apply to court to say it has an effect of a civil judgment, because it would have under A1.
It's taken a while to get there, but I'm sorry.
Now we've got the first point.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
No.
It's a Tuesday morning. We'll excuse you.
No, he's not. You took a while to get to your crisp.
I'm not as
clear. To get to your crisp.
Yeah. 6 months been divided for fines only.
Ms. Schaefer, you had a point to raise?
No, I was just basically that. I mean, 6 months better violence to fine, not compensation, and the compensation, it must be quite clear that, I mean, that, maybe we need to work out that a bit better as to how a judgment, once it's confirmed by a court, you can then execute as per normal, if you haven't paid. Then it's fine. As long as that's quite clear, then I agree.
I do see the point.
No, I'm fine.
Thank you.
Yes.
I'm not delaying, but Dr. Wink is to say, my view is that 6, in fact, is intended to say that if there is an order and it needs to be executed, it must only be done in terms of the either the rules of the court, whereas that A only talks about the confirmation that the order should be confirmed by the court. So I see a difference between six and A in terms of six spelling out, so that if a person must know that if the order has to be executed, it's not the concept that it has any power to execute. Either there must be some procedures which must be done specifically in terms of the rules of the court. I liken this to the small claims court. The small claims court specifically give an order. If the respondent as a small claims court commissioner, you don't have power, you can execute it. It must be referred to the
magistrate
court. Similarly, the council will sit and decide, the court will confirm it, but this one gives some light to say, for execution, you need to go to the
That's great, sir. In fact, just reading it carefully, if you read what 6 applies to, it applies to the failure to pay any amount which is due in terms of a sanction imposed. Now, the sanction is also Roman 1. The sanction is also compensation, because it says you may, that's part of the sentence. So A1 to whatever it is, 7 are all sanctions. So then that will apply to Roman 1 as well. So I think it's fine. You still got to go under Roman 1, you've got to go to a court order to confirm, and then 6 kicks in for execution. That's a civil judgment execution. So, but we can look at it whether you think it's unfair, but now.
Thank you,
Jonah.
Jonas.
Given
Derek.
Mr.
Dyer.
Thanks,
thank
you.
Chair. Out of clarity. What was the thinking from the committee? What was the thinking that when it came to compensation, which is not what ordinarily happens now, there are fines for conduct. And I think the concern was, that's not good enough. There needs to be something more that's happening. I must imagine that that was the thinking.
There must be something more.
Yes.
That is the department.
The divine, yes.
No, it came from the department or the prophets.
Yes.
Mm. Want to compensate. Well, they probably wanted to get punitive about it. And that's when we, with the committee, said, no, this is quantum. You can't decide it. But it came from the department.
I think this was contemplating the possibility of an attorney's conduct effectively causing financial damage to a client that may not be covered by the fund, and in that case then they wanted compensation to be awarded to the complainant. I don't know that there will be that many cases of where that would happen that isn't covered by insurance, but there may well be. And in that situation you can't have, you've got to be careful when you make an order to quantum how it's done. And I think it is right that the court should do it. It's usually done. Not for fines, only for compensation.
Okay, so it's not for fines, is it?
No.
Chair,
can I just clarify for drafting purposes? If the intention is that the court determines the quantum, shouldn't this intention of ours stipulate that? Because now it seems 3A1. Because currently, say, two parties in a civil case reach an agreement, the court confirms it and makes it an order of court, but the court doesn't reconsider the quantum or the decisions or the whatever they came to conclude. But if the court has to decide on quantum, I think we should specify, because a decision isn't a confirmation.
That's right. No, I'm afraid that was exactly the concern. So you're back into the left square one. The disciplinary committee can't do it all, does it? So that is the real question, which I think is why we're bringing it up again.
Was
that to be doing this at all?
Although,
it's different if parties actually agree. If the parties agree that this is fair and reasonable and they're happy to agree, then the court could confirm that agreement. Or maybe they wouldn't need to. Maybe if the parties agree, then it could exclude that.
What you're planning on going to see a police?
No, well, exactly. But that's what I was saying. If they do agree, then maybe we can exclude that from the process. And then just say that if the quantum has to be determined, then it has to go to the court.
But can they determine quantum?
I could recommend quantum, I would say.
Chair, I think a big number of these discipline hearings relate to fees, excessive fees.
Yes.
And I think in that instance, possibly a disciplinary committee could determine quantum by a fee determination. Things down. That is my thinking. Quantum that is punitive, possibly. That is might have to get external reports from psychologists or whatever. It's a whole different story.
Anyway, what they have to say, we can't now suddenly start saying non-punitive.
Compensation.
What did we say with the traffic involved? We also had a determination there,
yes,
for the awarding of compensation but was that a criminal court?
Along
the lines of section 300 of the criminal proceedings.
And they
yeah.
read all the evidence during the course of the trial, and they would have that to base there.
Can I ask a silly question? How long will all this take?
Jenny, you must anticipate that when this application is made to court for confirmation, the RV Oxford Parson don't apply. The guilty attorney advocate, legal practitioner, to oppose it in their presence
and appeal
and go to the Constitutional Court
and say I have matters before the court and I must deal with.
Mm.
Oh.
I mean, the purpose of this is disciplinary action really against the text. I mean, surely, I mean, I'm starting to wonder with all these questions whether we should actually have it at all, and which, whether it should rather be left to a civil action. I mean, if somebody is found guilty in this process, then surely maybe it would be better to leave damages claims to the courts as they usually would be. And they could then rely on the fact that they've been found guilty in this process if necessary, perhaps to help prove their case. But I'm starting to think maybe we should rather do that, because it is going to take a long time. And any panel who's going to make a recommendation to a court on quantum in any case is going to have to explain why and what basis they've come to that conclusion. And it might be okay in the case of financial matters, fairly easy. If it's been pure financial loss, but as you say, if it comes to other things and they start alleging they've been traumatised by the whole process and want to claim damages for psychological effects and stuff like that, it's going to go on and on and on forever and a day.
Yeah, the only, it's neat to say, but the only downside is that the poor complainant, who has already suffered all this prejudice, now has to go to court all over again. I mean, it is clean and it's pure, but I understand why somebody tried to deal with
is
it.
Is the complainant who goes to court?
Yeah, to enforce the guilty finding and get their money then.
No, it's not to enforce it.
The poor complainant has now
it. It's not to enforce it, though. It's just to claim damages.
In terms of the constituency work that I'm doing and some of the matters that I have received, and the one in particular is very interesting, because in this case the complainant made criminal action. Criminal action wasn't brought. You've got the disciplinary proceedings that are proceeding. And now she has instituted an action in the High Court for damages, but she can't continue with that because she doesn't have the finances. She doesn't have the finances to claim damages, which we are trying to cover here.
Mm-hmm.
So this would help her tremendously.
Yeah.
Because she
would
doesn't. It would, because she has got an order, and the idea would be that the council would then
that's
approach the High
Court.
This
is my question.
Oh.
Is it the complainant or the council?
No, the council would.
If it's the council, then I'm okay with that.
So, but whether so in that particular case, it would help, and I would think many in most cases would be liquid claims, as you say, it's a reduction of fees, it's an easily determinable. But when it comes to more to your more contentious sexual harassment or something like that, where you have to determine damages arising from that, you've got lawyers sitting on it. They're used to dealing with this. It's not like necessarily with due respect to your magistrates dealing with criminal work that aren't used to quantifying damages.
Mm-hmm.
And in the nature of the appointment of such a disciplinary hearing, if this is here, then when the panel is appointed, there could be one could look and say, well, he has a potential for a compensation claim. And the panel members. But I don't know, Chair. I would think in this case it would help complain. But I like the idea of order to pay compensation, which order is subject to confirmation on application by the two accord of law. So it's an application to court.
Okay.
But Mr. Dyer, I need your assistance from whether it can work in practice.
What happens if the court says no, we don't agree? We don't confirm, then what?
They will give guidance as to why, and they'll refer it back, like they do. They refer it back to the disciplinary here and say you've given too much or you've this, and then it goes back to the discipline, like they do.
Well, then what are they going to base that decision? I mean, there's going to have to be a whole lot of evidence laid then as to how they came to the compensation amount and all. I mean, you know, that could itself end up being a whole lot of thing.
I would imagine that the intention is not to settle the complainant with litigation costs of going to an attorney or advocate to put off papers to court for confirmation of a recommendation from the DC. I would imagine that it's never the intention.
No.
So, which then logically means surely we can't expect it from the complainant to go to court. Those costs are going to have to be. So it's are you opposed to the concept? No, I want to clarify that for purposes of drafting, I just thought that we would just ask these questions to seek clarity. And I think from just the discussion, it's an
area that causes a certain practical challenge. Because if the intention is never for the complainant to be saddled with those costs, it means then what you're saying, the council is actually meant to be.
Yes.
The amicus curiae sort of thing.
Definitely.
Joe, there must be merit in distinguishing between financial and non-financial, pecuniary loss and loss pain and otherwise.
Mm.
It's a lot easier for a panel to ascertain, say, well, we think that X attorney overcharged by this amount, therefore we'll make a compensation order for that amount. But it's very different in other kinds of matters.
Mm.
Section 300 is very specific of the criminal procedure, and it talks about loss suffered.
There's only malicious damage to
property type of stuff, yes, including
financial loss.
Yeah. That's limited very much to what is easily, what has already been factual.
That's right.
Yes.
No, we can't. I mean, they're just not going to complain. I guess they've got the means. Is Bassett, one little question for me. Down to sub 7, B, and then sub 8. Correctly say, if the disciplinary committee finds that the legal practitioner, etc., is not guilty, it must inform the complainant. I'm okay with that. But in sub 8, you say, if the legal practitioner is found guilty of misconduct, that must be published in a gazette or on the website. But should that not also be if the legal practitioner is found not guilty as well? Surely the legal practitioner will want that.
Maybe there's a bit of a contradiction, because we're already saying the outcome of a disciplinary matter must be published on the website.
Where do we say that?
We said that we discussed on in clause 38.
38
seems to be a contradiction.
Yeah, there's. Can you see what I'm saying?
I can. Sorry, Chair. I will have a look at that. There's a contradiction between 7 and 8 and clause 38.
Okay. All right. So irrespective of the finding, it must be published.
It must be published in the Gazette.
Not the Gazette.
Sorry, David.
The Gazette.
Well, Gazette and website.
I thought you said no Gazette.
We've got to.
We rejected the Gazette the other day on the other matter.
And we rejected the Gazette.
We did on the other one last week. But I mean, the point is, who reads the Gazette anyway?
Yeah.
Seriously.
Very few people.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, but the point there was, look, it was 600 rand a page.
Yes.
And the point was, we didn't feel it necessary to publish the role of legal professionals. But this is. I mean, the number of items here are going to be so much fewer. I mean, if 200 cases were dealt with per annum by the northern provinces, no, but that's per annum. So I mean, that's presumably you split that over the 10 of the 12 months, for argument's sake. So it's just a few, you know. This time it's not so many things, and it does absolutely no harm to Gazette as well as website.
Oh,
yeah. Look, why not?
That's 600 rand.
Yeah,
a page. But on the page you can put the outcome of 20 cases.
So for me the purpose is relevant. I mean, what is the purpose? The purpose is to inform people about it. It's going to be informed by putting it on the website. What's the point of putting it in the Gazette that no one reads anyway?
No, but it's
all
the government Gazette. It's a record. It's a record.
We didn't hear that from David.
I think we must put it on Facebook.
We need to instruct Mr. Bassett, because if we're saying wherever it speaks of the Gazette must come out, then let that be for the reasons that he has raised.
as I indicated, this is different from the roll. The roll journey is going to be pages and pages, so this might be less in terms of. So that that's just one of the considerations the committee could take into account.
Well, cost is one thing, the other is who goes to the gazette.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Don't there be very many people who spend their
afternoon
there? Very few people go there.
That's what happens, there's on public records. It's public records, it's public records.
And reflect.
One day there's a big cyber attack, books, everything goes down, and lost all sorts of website. I mean, there is still such a thing that the government is able to take.
I'm glad you said Bush. All right, let's flag it, Mr. Bassett. Sorry, I thought we'd get clarity now.
Yeah, just to take you back to your query, I saw see my footnote. You had the query about clause 39.8.
Yes.
I did say in the footnote there, this sub-clause might be unnecessary if the department's proposal in clause 38 is accepted.
Oh, I see.
Okay. Maybe we can delete this here.
38.3 is accepted. Outcome and any sanction, if applicable, must be published, etc., etc. Okay?
So we can take it out.
Take it out. Yes.
The heading refers to remedial
action. Where are they? Where are the examples of the remedial action? The sanctions is what we're talking about.
Yes. Well, the remedial action I think they are referring to is the order of compensation, suspension, payment of the fine.
Those are also remedial.
From the legislative drafting point of view, I think sanctions would be better because if you have a look at sub clause. B talks about in addition to the sanctions, subclause 4A talks about a combination of the sanctions. So if I may.
Can we agree that in our same charges we've got a very serious charge that sanction of reprimand? Can we change it to a warning? But what is interesting is actually Ms. Munch raises a good point. There isn't really any remedial action.
Yeah, I'm dealing with that. I mean, what now? You've got a
candidate attorney that messes up or something, and a condition. But I'm sure that's within the jurisdiction of the disciplinary process to impose a condition of suspension if you don't attend law school or something. Do a course or something like that. That is.
Because subclause 4, Chair, the disciplinary committee may postpone the taking of any steps or suspend the imposition of any sanctions on conditions
that's
as it may determine.
That's the remedial action.
It's also a sanction.
Of an investigation or disciplinary hearing. its own decision for that of the disciplinary body, or if the outcome that the ombud could, in respect of a review regarding the outcome of an investigation or disciplinary hearing, confirm the findings and actions taken, or if there's been a miscarriage of justice, to set aside the finding and to substitute his or her own, and to notify the complainant and legal practitioner of the outcome. So that provision, it was suggested, if the review powers of the ombud are to stay, they also, from a drafting point of view, in the wrong chapter, they should be in chapter 5, which deals with appeals. So that is just to give you a background what we've done there. And these review powers, in line with the committee's suggestions, are now the complainant can go to the appeal tribunal now to appeal against the outcome of the investigating committee or the disciplinary committee, as the legal practitioner could have done in the first place, in terms of the points introduced.
Is it implied that your members of the appeal tribunal will not be members of the investigation or the disciplinary
committee? Do we still get that the next?
Because you might want to say, other than those that serve on the,
We haven't, I think clause 42 deals with the appeal tribunal, so we've still got to get there,
okay.
And maybe that's something that we need to
just put
in there,
because otherwise you have the same members of the structure.
But
secondly, I'm just trying to think of the structure and the time that this is now going to take, because you've got this process, you've got the investigation takes place first, and that time has come up. Then you've got the disciplinary hearing, then you've got the appeal, then you've got the review by the ombudsman. Then any of those steps can be taken on review directly to a high court. Of course, you must first use your internal mechanisms as far as possible. But I'm just trying to think, if you've got an attorney whose career is at stake, they can drag this on for years. Absolutely years. But I don't know what the solution is. I'm just concerned, and maybe the solution is to look at the ombudsman, whether that review process is not in too much in addition to this appeal process.
No,
is it desirable to have both processes?
Yeah, but look at it, it's a good suggestion.
It's a good suggestion. I'm not opposed to it, but I'm just thinking of the different steps that can be taken. You can drag this out, and yes, there is the urgent provision that you can stop a practitioner if they trust monies and that type of thing. But I suppose that's the normal course of law. But what we are introducing is an internal mechanism of review by the ombud, which is not necessarily undesirable, but that is in addition to your external review process to a high court. So you've got all these avenues as a legal practitioner that you will exhaust every single one of them.
Yeah, but the ombud here helps the complainant.
So does the appeal.
Chair, yes, if I remember the discussions, and I think it was Mr. Jeffrey, as he then was, to say this, that's why these internal things should stop at the appeal tribunal for the complainant and the legal practitioner, and that's possibly why the ombud shouldn't have these decision-making powers. So that is why clause 41 is put in square brackets, and I don't think it's a consideration that the committee has made.
Well, think about it. It's very nice and powerful for the lay person, the complainant.
And I think it was also mentioned the implications, the cost implications, the financial implications for the legal ombud to have these powers also. To have all these powers, decision-making powers, appeal powers, review powers, are going to require a lot of manpower, womanpower, and resources.
Just from my view of thinking about it, I tend to agree that must look very carefully at the ombud having any review power over the panel, because you're kicking in a whole nother step and it could be taken again with the papers to be filed, adding to his burden. I think we need to ensure that we've got an effective appeal mechanism. And remember, at that point, that's the internal mechanism still. You've got three steps up to that. You've got the investigation, you've got the disciplinary hearing, you've got an appeal mechanism, and then to add another internal mechanism of a review becomes, and besides the cost implications, but I think we should look at strengthening the appeal mechanism, the internal appeal mechanism. And you can rest assured that an attorney that is, and we help the complainant at that point, and many parties' constitutions allow that process as well, internal appeal again by complainant. And then the attorney, or the legal practitioner, if he doesn't like it, he'll take that whole process on review to the High Court. So we will relieve the ombud of a lot of unnecessary work and costs, and we'll reduce that. Thank you. But I'm not, I'm saying,
you must show me that the appeal process that is so complainant-free.
Absolutely. Let's look at strengthening that. Let's look at strengthening
that. And we trust Mr. Best.
Yeah, I think one could maybe stronger than what's in the bill at the moment, and that's where the counter argument, or one of the arguments, one of the ways of doing that is to make sure that the transparency is up to scratch. But there might be other options. We were requested to look at the transparency aspect, which I think we've done, bearing in mind that all these structures are set up by the council. But there might be other ways of strengthening the appeal. The appeal structure to make it more complainant friendly.
The opinion of the public on the appeal, no lawyers.
Yeah, I was going to say that we need to make sure that the appeal tribunal also has provision for members of the public, to be honest. Not to be exclusively there.
Oh. At least one.
Very suspicious about it.
I know from both sides of the coin, and I know what some members of the public expect from practitioners, and it's just totally and utterly unrealistic, and often, and you know, not even necessarily legally required. And people have an understanding as to what they think the lawyer should do. The lawyer knows what they are supposed to do, and they don't always meet.
Yeah.
Mm. And it can be quite daunting.
Mm.
Should we go on to the actual appeal? Tribunal, that's clause 42.
Can I just ask you, Chairman, before Lawrence starts, if you mean us to sit over lunch on the shortlisting of the Human Rights Commission?
Not over lunch, after lunch.
Oh, after lunch.
After lunch.
The question is with rule.
The ways we're going to sit during lunch, after lunch.
Yeah. No, I thought we could break now and
sit over lunch. No. After lunch, at 2 o'clock when we reconvene.
All right.
42, Mr. Bassett.
Thank you, Chair. These are some of the provisions that I said right at the beginning of this this discussion in Clause 37 would be transferred. So I'm just reminding members. Clause 42 deals with the appeal structure, and it says, subject to Section 44, a legal practitioner, candidate legal practitioner, juristic entity may, as determined in the rules, within a certain time period, of being informed of the decision of a disciplinary committee, lodge an appeal with an appeal tribunal established in terms of subsection 2 against a finding by the disciplinary committee or against the sanction imposed or both. Subject to section 44 was at the suggestion of the law LSSA to endorse the fact that in urgent legal proceedings these provisions might be bypassed. Then subclause 1B provides, subclause 1A deals with the appeal by the legal practitioner. Subclause 1B deals with the complainant. They're divided into two, because remember the complainant was originally going to go to the ombud, but now we've been requested to board an option where the complainant also goes to the appeal tribunal. And a complainant who is aggrieved by the manner in which an investigating committee conducted its investigation, or the outcome of the investigating committee, or the outcome of a disciplinary hearing referred to in section 40, may, as determined in the rules within the time period, lodge an appeal. against any conduct or finding of the investigating committee or the disciplinary committee, as the case may be.
Mm-hmm.
And here we come to the composition of the appeal tribunal, and we might, as has already been suggested, that there should be provision for layperson. An appeal tribunal must consist of not less than 3 and not more than 5 persons appointed by the council, one of whom the council must designate as chairperson or presiding officer thereof. The members of the appeal tribunal must be legally qualified with relevant expertise, and then the decision-making provisions for the appeal tribunal, a decision of the majority president is the decision of the appeal tribunal, and it also makes provision for decision-making in the event of a deadlock, a casting vote, and a deliberative vote. What can the appeal tribunal do? It may dismiss the appeal against the finding or decision of an investigating committee or disciplinary committee and confirm the finding or sentence or both, or uphold the appeal against the decision of a disciplinary committee only or in part and set aside or vary the finding or sentence or both. If a legal practitioner who has been found guilty lodges an appeal in terms of subsection 1, the decision of the disciplinary committee may not be enforced before the appeal tribunal has decided the appeal. So that's what the appeal tribunal is about, Chair. I think we must also make sure, I would like to think it would happen as a matter of course, but that any person that's been part of a previous panel may not be on such a panel.
It does, but it's wise with lawyers to actually put it there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Dealing with lawyers, do you?
That's shocking.
Yes, it is.
Don't worry, I've got a few choice things here about politicians who want me to eat now. It's hilarious, actually. When a politician sees light at the end of the tunnel, they go out and buy some more tubs. Very bad. Seriously bad decisions, please. I'm going to tell you that. I'll tell you that.
You like it, Mr.
Diane. I promise you all the bread you can eat is no
Exactly. You might want to use everything you need in contrast. Yeah.
Good point. Good point.
Yeah. No, I know of places where they need bridges.
And
there's no river.
Yeah.
Later on, when you distribute Charles City Bridge piece, I mean, he's used a quote at the top, a Joyce Carol Oates quote at the top of the page. Which is about the most unflattering thing about lawyers.
Yeah.
Shakespeare,
when you get the Shakespeare, said you. No, it's not a really
comparison with
sharks,
but referring not only to the mouth, but the long gut behind it,
as
really awful.
I
think they're saving
graces,
people like
Pais
Lung
and
the Jesuits.
And all the many lawyers who are very honourable and
sure. Sure. I can see that readily.
No, more than one family of lawyers, successive generations. I love them. But it's the ones who misbehave who therefore make me so extra angry.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Others will read. What happens if a politician drowns in a river? That's the solution. What happens if all of them drown? That's the solution.
Yeah, the solution is to drown them all.
Oh, I've heard the same one about lawyers. What do you call a lawyer at the bottom of the... What do you call a lawyer knee-deep in cement? No, I've forgotten about it. No, what do you call 10 lawyers knee-deep in cement at the bottom of the river?
Yeah.
A good stop.
A good stop.
No, that's terrible.
You notice how some compression this is operating.
All of this.
There's a lawyer walking along the catwalk of the fence and he fell into the water.
Yeah,
yeah. And that's a shock. So. How on earth did you get that right? That's professional criticism.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. I've heard it's a good deal. If they stop telling lies about me, I'll stop telling the truth about me.
All right.
right, let's get back to interesting.
Serious matters.
Serious matters. Anything else on 40?
I think it might also assist for people to be involved in the process so they can also get to understand what the legal obligations are, in other words, what they are allowed to do, what they aren't allowed to do, and why, so on and so forth. Then that might actually assist the whole relationship between attorneys and clients.
I think in Mr. Bassett's mind, this is an appeal
And that's what was appealing about the ombud, because it's a retired judge, as we've decided, it's a place you can go, a place that will assist you, we have confidence that it will be fair. And people also have confidence that an appeal tribunal will be fair, but for them.
Okay.
What can we invent that can help? Kev, you are now the co-complainant. The LPB in its regional incarnation has had a disciplinary sitting. They find the lawyer not guilty. You're not happy. You've lost money. You've lost this. You've lost that. Now, what comfort is there? Who is there who's going to help you a little bit to take this thing on appeal?
Well, clearly everything's going to go on appeal.
There was no appeal process in terms of the Attorneys Act. There was a disciplinary process, and if you're unhappy, then you go to court. And I suppose people didn't go to court because they couldn't, because they couldn't afford it. Now we're providing the appeal so that there is at least that extra. I'm trying to argue for the complainant. There is something for the complainant, but what other measures can be put in place to assist the complainant aside the transparency of it?
Established law is an internal process. It's an internal process.
Internal how? The complainant is a member of the public.
No, but that's the established law, the Jockey Club cases, for example. Now, those are not statutory in the Jockey Club cases. That's your whole disciplinary action. So, that's why often you don't allow outside legal assistance. It's similar to your labour hearings, where you allow shop stewards to act for you, but not lawyers to resolve it. But we've got a statutory body, we align access to by the public. Let me give you a correlation with criminal cases. Any member of the public is entitled to go and sit and listen to a criminal case, but the media is not by right allowed to broadcast. They have to make application to the magistrate
that's
to broadcast.
The media are allowed to sit in there and make notes about
maybe it's just something that we should look at. I'm not opposed to it, I'm just saying should there be, if it's a very highly publicized case, do you have to bring application to broadcast it live or something? Is that what you're concerned about?
Yeah.
That issue.
Where's our medical
presence? Obviously the broadcasting media would ask the presiding officer to be allowed in.
They're allowed to report on it. They're allowed to report on it in newspapers.
Yes,
not allowed to be tethered by that. Since the case is called in court, they can report on it unless it's in case. So the point is we've made this, I mean, I agree with Steve. I mean, they are generally, and that's why for the MPA it was a breaking block matter that they haven't had to go to court to make application to be tethered by. But I mean, I thought we got past this point long ago, because we all know that disciplinary processes are generally private, and we made the decision that they must be, in this case, public, in line with doctors.
Quite right. And we used the comparison of the medics, where we established that their disciplinaries were open, but we didn't directly deal with the question whether that meant open to the media, but you can't draw a distinction. You know, open is open. There's no distinction.
As far as broadcasting.
Your default position is open.
Okay.
Condition time. Then we've got the provision that says, of course, turn, they can close, whatever.
Okay. So if ETV rock up with their cameras, the presiding officer must allow them in?
No.
The default position, you can then, as the accused, you can say, well, you applied to the son of, I don't want to. The default position is open. You then say it must be closed.
Perhaps, I mean, I don't know what the situation is regarding photos in court. I don't think they're allowed to take photographs and publish photos on contract court. But maybe we could say, you know, for print media, they can report on it. But if they want to televise it, you know, then they must make applications.
Court chair, talking about the magistrates, because there were regulations a little while back on those, and broadcasting
yes,
of television,
yeah.
You apply to the court for
yeah.
permission before the court stopped. It used to be you had to apply to the magistrates' commission, and that was changed. So it's just an application to court for it to be broadcast.
Logical.
And now you have the ridiculous situation where people come in as accused with their faces covered.
Yeah.
And I'm amazed the court allows it. Absolutely amazed.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, shall we break for lunch?
Yes.
2 o'clock, all right? 2 o'clock.